Okay, welcome everybody to Masterclass. Today, December 15th, 2022. We're coming close to the end of things here. We have another one next week on the 22nd. No, we don't. Or do we? Do we? No, we don't. Oh my gosh, what do we have? Do we have one for the 22nd?
I believe so. I put down for it.
Okay, good. All right.
But I need to change mine from 15 minutes to 30 minutes.
So, okay. So, we do have one on the 22nd. As it goes, because we are still doing meetings next week, but because we typically go by the schedule that the school goes by. So, the schedule for them, of course, is you are off starting the 24th. So, on the 22nd, we will still have masterclass. And then it won't start again until January 5th. And I know that for sure. This evening, we have four speakers, 15 minutes each. We have Sean Phillips, Marcus Clay, Coco Gorvego, and Mauricio Ramirez. Sean, are you ready to start?
I don't know that we're going to get through it in 15 minutes, but as far as we can get. You guys can hear me. Testing.
Yes, they hear you.
Do I just take over and share? So, as stated, I'm going to start the walkthrough of the Precious Hack-A-Box machine. To conserve time, I have already connected to my VPN, started the machine, and preloaded a lot of the scripts. The main outcome of this is trying to explain my thought process and how I like to keep forward motion, forward thought in everything that I do while going through the process. And with any Hack the Box machine, the very first thing you generally always want to start doing is a scan. For me, this is my Kali Linux instance that I created at the beginning of the class and loaded it with the tools. Kali does come preloaded like most distros with the tools you need to do the things you need to do. One of the tools that I like for scanning is Legion. It's based off Nmap like Zenmap. And the reason I like it is because it has a lot of additional features. I also like this lovely little scan bar. Especially the word polite for the scan. You can bump it up to the hard module, which gives you a lot of other features that you would get through Nmap as well. But some of the features that it gives you, it shows you the status of the scan, how it's going. As it finds services, it'll pop them up here live. As you'll start to see, it found an open port here, and it took a screenshot of the site. That it found. Doesn't look like it found much. Looks like we have a DNS issue. It also will pull up scripts that it can find for the sites, as well as any information related to the open ports and CVEs related to the vulnerabilities that the site might have issues with. You know, so just kind of a one-stop shop for all of these tools for what you need. And all of this information in my process is you generally want to document everything. So here we have a OpenSSH on a DBAN server. We can see the version number. We can see some CVEs that we might want to research for some vulnerabilities that we might be able to exploit. We have Nginx on a web server and its version. Another feature that I like about Kali is it has a built-in exploit tool called Searchploit, where you'd be able to check to see if there's any known exploits for what you found. Here you can see we're on version 1.18, and it looks like there might be a denial of service attack, which doesn't do us any good because we're not looking to take the site down. We could also do a search exploit for OpenSSH to see if there's anything there. And unfortunately for 8.4p1, it looks like they've kept the system fairly updated, so there's not really much we can do there that's positive. But, you know, we still have all this information here that we can look at to see if there's anything there. And we still have this website that looks like we need to fix the DNS issue with first. So the way to fix that is to go to your host file. Actually, I have to enter a password there. That helps. And this is going to allow my Kali instance to resolve that website. So that when we bring it up, we should see what it is. And it looks like a very basic website that will convert any web page we want to a PDF. And if there's anything playing around with Hack the Box has taught us, it's that whenever we see an entry field like this, one of the first things we want to try to do is to see if it's possibly susceptible to a script injection. So, you know, I preloaded this lovely little Hello World script alert. Hopefully it'll pop up something. But it doesn't look like it does. But, you know, I still, at this point, haven't ran out of things to try. You know, it's saying that it'll convert a web page to a PDF. And, you know, any developer here will say, well, the only way it can do that is through an API or an app or a plugin or something like those. That, and those generally have their own exploits that you can take care of. So first we need to find out what that is. And the best way to do that would be to get a PDF from it. So we can try converting Google, see if it'll work. And apparently it doesn't work. And we can try Yahoo. And I notice that doesn't work either. But, you know, one of the big things about this website I notice is it's not secure. So maybe when it was designed, they didn't take that HTTPS redirection into mind. So one of the best things we could do is create our own website. That way it's using HTTP instead of HTTPS. And then try that and see if it'll convert that. And again, I have it preloaded. And we can see that it's converted it to a PDF. And we're just going to open it. Another tool we can use is built into Kali is the XFI tool, which will show us data about the PDF file. But for me, you know, it's all about the graphic interface because I hate remembering commands if I can avoid it. And here I noticed that it was created in some tool that I've never heard of before. So from here, I did some research. You know, at this point, it goes into a research phase. And one of the first things in my research I found on Sneak.io was that PDF Kit was designed by Ruby, and that any version below 8.7 was susceptible to packet injection. Well, we're using, according to the website, it's using 8.7. And it even gives you the parameters that you could pass to test it. So one of the things we did, let me find it over here in my cheat sheet, is to test that sleep command to see if we can get the website. And if you recall, when we hit the submit last time, it was pretty instant on popping up that PDF file. So now, by doing this, it should theoretically sleep for 5 seconds before converting the thing. And it did. So we now know that this process is susceptible to injection, which means we have our endpoint. The next thing we can do is create our listener, which I have done over here. And get back over here using that same script, loading it with a bash command that will execute a bash shell to my listener. We should successfully get access to their website. And from here, we can do an ls, see what we are. We can do a who am I to see who we are. We're user Ruby, and we have a basic outline of the website here. But if anything, Try Hack Me starting points have taught us that's not really where they keep user data. They generally keep it in the root directory. So heading over there should be our first spot and running a list, but we don't have anything, so we might need to run an advanced list. So we'll list out the directory. And let's do a search for any, you know, hidden files. And here we got, let's see, we got some bash history, we got some bash logout, we got a .bundle.cache.profile. So normally we would just go through these files one by one, but since I'm running short on time, I'm just going to skip ahead to .bundle. Because in here, oh, sorry, change directory to .bundle. And then list this directory out. And in here we can see we have a config file. And the command to get that config file is cat. And it shows us that we have a username as well as a password. Now, that doesn't help us anything from here, but if we go back and recall that there was an open SSH port, you know, what are the chances that this was like a normal human being who uses the same password for everything and was therefore lazy and used that same password for that? There. Entering in the password. We find we have access now to the SMTP debian server, and listing that out, we have user.txt. And from here, we know that going into that user.txt is most likely going to give us our flag, which I'm not going to show you all because, you know, that would give you guys the box a little too easily. But, you know, the key here is that I always document everything that I get. You know, everything could be useful. If that didn't give me any headway or I got stuck any point along the way, I would have started looking through these to see if I had any information or insight here. Legion gives you a brute force tool where I could have started brute forcing the root password or the admin password. And when I initially did this box, I actually used Metasploit. Because there's multiple tools and ways to do everything, I actually used Metasploit and found around 15 other accounts that were active and viable. I just, you know, haven't found the passwords for them yet, including root, admin, Sally, Tom, and then I did find Henry, but I couldn't find his password because that was a fairly complicated, complex password. You know, so it's all about, you know, data collection and information and processing it. But in the end, if you keep that forward progress, forward momentum going and don't stall out, you should capture those flags. And that's all I have. Put it over. Not too bad.
Awesome. Great job.
Stop sharing.
That was quite a run, man. Well, you know a lot about that. That's for sure. Yeah. That's for sure. Let me get back to my window here. Where it was. We will have questions later on, I'm sure. On my list. Here we go. All right, next. Marcus Clay, are you ready?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, go ahead.
All right, 1 second. Can anybody see that all right?
I do.
All right.
Yes.
All right, I want to first thank everybody for joining this masterclass presentation. I'll be presenting about wireless. Most people use Wi-Fi in their daily lives, but don't know what it is or how it really works. So by the end of this presentation, I hope to leave you guys with some insight on it. All right, the first thing we got are some key terms that I would like to share. There are several terms, acronyms that I could literally just go on the whole 15 minutes about, but these are some most important ones. We have annotation, which is signal loss, amplification, signal gain, absorption, signal reduction. That and annotation really goes hand in hand, like flip-flop, depends on the context of how you're going. We got reflection, which is the signal bounce off, scattering, which the signal separates, refraction, which the signal bends as it passes through object, and diffraction. And then I got a little diagram down here to show how each of it does. And then this is the annotation, like how much signal loss you lose per material. All right. There are two types of physical channels that we use when passing data, bounded and unbounded, is what path our data takes, whether it's sound, radio, or whatever. Bounded is the simple one, so I'm going to start there. In a bounded medium, all signals are contained within the medium itself, and they are not allowed to exit except for like small leakage, crosstalks. There are several types of bounded media, such as wires, coax cables, waveguides, and optical fiber cables. Unbounded media is which data travel through the air, which most people just call wireless. So when you send data from A to B, it doesn't go in a straight line point to point. It scatters, so it has to fight with everything else in the air that's broadcasting. Wireless also works in half duplex, which means it can't receive and send at the same time. Some examples of bounded media are microwaves, radio waves, infrared rays, satellites. Wireless technology offers many advantages compared to traditional wired networks. One of the main advantages of wireless is the ability to provide anywhere, anytime connectivity. Wireless technology is fairly easy and it's inexpensive to install. The cost of home and business wireless devices continue to decrease, yet despite this decrease in cost, the data rate and capacity of these devices have increased, allowing much faster, reliable wireless connection. Wireless technologies enable networks to easily expand without limitation of cable connections. New and visiting users can join the network quickly and easily. Now we're going to talk about frequency and wavelengths. Frequency is something that happens over a period of time. For example, driving down road 70 miles per hour or a heartbeat of 120. In Wi-Fi, we're talking about this 360-degree wave that starts at zero and ends at 360. The motion can take any shape as long as it starts at zero and ends at 360. Way I like to memorize it, for example, we have a local radio station here, 98.3. That means its frequency is 98.3 million times per second. And Wi-Fi, we use frequency of 2.4 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz, which 6 gigahertz is on the rise. Those cycles are 2.4, 5, and 6 billion times per second. Some other key things to take note is amplitude and wavelength. Which is the height of the wave, the peak is known as the crest. The higher the amplitude, the more energy is being used, and the wavelength is comparison between those crests. Next, we were to talk about the phase in Wi-Fi. A phase is the position of the wave at a point in time of a cycle. It provides a measurement of exactly where the wave is positioned. A complete wave cycle is 360 degrees of a phase. In my first example here, the two signals are completely in sync. We call this being in phase. And what this will do is actually amplify the signals so you're able to hear, your computer's able to hear it more. And my second example here is called 180 out of phase. Both waves reach the rest points at the same time, but they're actually opposite of each other. What's actually happened here is it's not that the signal is flipped, but this bottom one is actually just delayed slightly, giving it that shape. Next, ways to antennas are ways to strengthen Wi-Fi and RF signals. The three main types of antennas are omnidirectional, semidirectional, and highly directional. Omnidirectional antennas radiate radio frequencies in all directions. These antennas have like a donut-shaped radiation pattern, are ideal for connecting devices that are on the same plane and can either go either way. A good way to think about this is the sun, how it just shines down on all of us. Semidirectional antennas are antennas that focus energy in one direction. Its main purpose for short, medium-range, remote wireless bridge networks to connect different buildings or campuses. Think about like a desk lamp. It doesn't light up the whole room, but that focus area is pretty lit, and then there's some gets leeway. And highly directional antennas are used for long distance point-to-point communication. They're used to bridge networks between two buildings that are far apart or like quarries. This is like a laser pointer or a spotlight. And there's always math one. All right, so when we're coming to measuring RF, there's the rules of tens and threes. If you lose 3 decibels, your power is half. If you gain 3 decibels, your power is double. If you lose 10 decibels, your power is a tenth. If you gain 10 decibels, your power is 10 times. The reasons why we use decibels instead of milliwatts is because milliwatt is an absolute value, and we really can't use an absolute value when describing gain and losses to help. So say this is my AP. Terrible drawing, but. And my AP is connected to my antenna here. Let's say my AP is giving off, I got it set to 100 milliwatts. And when it hits the antenna, only 50 milliwatts is gone. I can't say that this cable here is a 50 milliwatt loss cable, because what if I increase the power of the AP? It becomes 1,500. But what I can say is this cable is a 3 decibel loss cable, because no matter what this value is here, we know that it's going to be half coming out the other end. All right, we got radio band 2.4 versus 5 gigahertz. You might be thinking to yourself, what difference does it make? Which radio band did we use? I'm going to paint a picture for you. Think about sitting in a park and you're driving at a park and a car drives by and it's listening to blasting its music. What do you hear? Most likely you hear that deep bass boom. Even when the car is out of sight, you still can hear it. That's because lower frequencies can travel farther. So now you're probably thinking, why don't we just use low frequencies? The upside to higher frequencies is it supports more bandwidth, which means more traffic can pass through. The 2.4 was designed for devices that are taken from room to room or from far away from a router, because its range is much longer and its ability to penetrate is much easier. Downside to 2.4 is it gets easily congested, which we'll talk about here when we talk about channels. In Wi-Fi, interference caused by wireless devices transmitted at the same frequency. The same frequency range may be used by cordless phones, wireless networks, baby monitors, and anything else in the IoT world. Wi-Fi performance may be slowed down, and the network connections may be broken by these devices caused by CSMA/CA, or the carrier sense multiple access with collision avoidance, which is a device in wireless technologies that reserves the channel and prevents collisions. In 2.4, we only have 11 channels, but it's best practice we only use 3, 1, 6, and 11, so that every other one don't overlap exists. Unlike 2.4 gigahertz channels, All 25 channels of the 5 gigahertz channels are non-overlapping at 20 megahertz wide. So we can even combine those channels to make them larger if needed. There are a few that are best practice to avoid due to DFS, dynamic frequency selection. So if those devices are listening in on those channels, they pick up something on its a radar, such like a military satellite or weather radar, it has to disconnect for 3 hours and it can't go on back to that channel. This caused disruption to many users and as well as others. Too far. All right, we got SSID. We use the SSID to identify a specific wireless network. It is essentially the name of the network. Wireless routers usually broadcast their configured SSID by default. The SSID broadcast allows other devices and wireless clients to automatically discover the name of the wireless network. A lot of people like to disable or hide their SSID, as we'll talk to on the next slide about security. Bad actors can use open or unsecure wireless networks to conduct illegal activities, monitor web traffic, steal information, and more. In cybersecurity terms, war driving is used to describe individuals who drive, walk, or slowly walk around through dense populated areas with wireless equipped laptops or smartphones, searching for unsecure wireless networks to connect to. You can use MAC address filtering. This is able you to specify identity who is allowed to connect to your network. This makes the wireless network more secure, but it also reduces the flexibility when it comes to joining new devices. You can also use a VPN to encrypt your user internet connection. It also can conceal your user IP address by using a virtual IP address that it assigns. Future of Wi-Fi. Next, Wi-Fi 6 is slowly being adopted now, and it's much better than its previous generation, which is 5 gigahertz. It max out throughput is 9.6 gigabytes per second, whereas Wi-Fi 5 offers only 3.5 gigabits. And then we also have AI that's joining. And which is part of Juniper's unique AI-driven supported model. Marvis is an essential virtual member of your IT team that provides unsuppressed insight and automation. The tool constantly learns and is ingests more data using its growing knowledge based on proactivity, correction issues, and real-time. And then if I have time, I would actually like to show y'all Marvis. Give me 1 second. All right, all right, so this is Marvis here. And what Marvis does is he scans our system and tell us if there's any issues. I can even go and ask him a question. Any issues? So Marvis was scanning. He was like, oh, he found something, AP Health. And then I could tell him to investigate it. And then he was like, give me some more options. I could say location. This, he will bring up a map and he'll show us all our APs. And he'll highlight which one and give me much more details on it. He also has this where we go on our service level. And what I really like about it is it gives us historical data, because people always come up to me around end of the day and say they had issues with something, but they never tell me, oh, it happened early in the day. So I could actually tell me if I'm having DHCP authorization. It actually breaks down what it is, and it actually gives me recommendations and time frames, how many users. And that is it for this presentation.
Wow, thank you. Just more information we did not know. I didn't know all that about wireless, really. That's pretty crazy.
Stop sharing.
That is something. Thank you so much for that information.
Oh, where's my stop sharing button? Stop sharing.
There you go. All right. So next we have Coco, and she's going to help us out with Mac OS versus Windows, which I'm looking forward to that too.
It's hard to follow those two presentations because mine is not technical at all. So I do apologize.
It's okay. It's going to help because there's always a problem with Mac, right?
Well, poor Mac. Yeah, let me do my screen share. Yeah. Wait, I don't know what I just did. Do you guys see anything?
Yeah, we can see your slides.
Oh, okay. Okay, good. All right, good evening, everybody. Tonight, I am going to talk briefly about some differences between Mac OS and Windows. So a little history, Mac was developed by Apple in 2001, and Windows was developed by Microsoft in 1985. So there are several reports out about the percentage of Mac users versus Windows users, and this graph shows like the green are all Windows users, about 87%, and Mac comes in at 9%, and we have Linux, which is about 1%. Again, there are several reports out there, so it's hard to tell exactly how many Mac users how many people are using Mac versus Windows. I can say just from my classes, usually it's just me or one other person that has a MacBook. So I can tell that there's not a lot of people who go with Apple. A lot of people prefer using Windows. There's another report that says there are 100 million active Mac users, whereas Windows comes about 1.4 billion. So that's just a huge difference. So installation, to install Mac, you can use System Preferences, the Apple Store, or downloading a disk image. Windows has a voice installation, and I think they have the Hello feature and also Face login. All right, to install apps on the Mac, you will typically see the picture up here that makes you drag the image into the application folder, which is not really third-party friendly. I have gotten lots of errors. I've had to restart several times when trying to install apps. Whereas Windows is pretty easy and straightforward, and Windows also supports third-party apps. So another thing to consider when deciding which operating system to use is security. Of course, that's a major part of what we do. And Windows is lacking in this department. There are a lot of malware with Windows, spyware, viruses. Windows, however, offers the Windows Defender Firewall to help with these vulnerabilities. Mac has a pretty good record as far as being safer, but a good antivirus system is recommended. Although Mac seems to be less vulnerable, I will say it's probably because there's not a whole lot of Mac users. That could be another reason why, because if you have more people using Windows, there are more vulnerabilities, there are more Windows machines to target. So it's hard to say Windows is less safer than Mac because there's just not a whole lot of users with Mac. I hope I'm making sense. Okay. And when Mac has another security feature called a gatekeeper. This is by Apple and it's a prompt. So if you try to download an app, you will usually get a prompt like this. This is just saying that Apple cannot verify that a file is free from malware. So if you download it, you are doing it at your own risk. And this is this usually makes me stop to think, okay, do I really need to download this file? Is this something I can get from the Apple store to make sure that at least there's some type of guarantee that, you know, it doesn't have malware? So that's just another feature that Mac offers. Okay, another cool thing that I found out was accessibility. Both operating systems support users with disabilities, but Microsoft has been consistent and has made it top priority. For example, a blind person is able to set up Windows using their voice. And Windows also has adaptive accessories for alternate inputs. Also, what I found interesting was that the American Sign Language is a big supporter of Microsoft. So, which operating system is better? I think this depends on your ecosystem, your smartwatches, your tablet, your business needs. What are you using it for every single day? If you are a gamer, Windows is better for people who do a lot of gaming. But if you are on the creative side, it's recommended that you use Mac. So I am a Mac user. I am not a gamer. I am not creative at all. But I just like how all of my Apple products are connected to each other. It helps me stay on track. I'm able to organize my life a little easier that way. But Mac can be annoying, and that's something that I discovered my time here at Purdue. A lot of my classes, a lot of the labs, the instructions were all for Windows users. So I found myself doing more research, trying to figure out how to convert certain commands, for example, that a Windows user might use, I have to convert that into a Mac user. So reading a lot of documentations help. Google was my friend. YouTube was my friend. But it got frustrating at times just getting through some of those courses because I had to put in extra work. to research that part. So I think I think the school should look into providing maybe options, like the school should give instructions for both Mac users and Windows users, because by the time I got into my classes that require me having a Windows computer, I didn't have money to go out and buy a new computer. But if I knew I needed this before enrolling, I would have probably gone ahead and purchased a Windows computer over a Mac, because it's just easier to me to use Windows for school. So another thing that helped me was VirtualBox. I use virtualization a lot during my time here at Purdue, and VMware Fusion, Peridot Desktop, and VirtualBox were the three that I found helpful. VMware Fusion, though, there is a, you have to pay, and I couldn't get a free version. It just wasn't working on my Mac. Peridot Desktop was a hassle as well. So I ended up going with VirtualBox, which if you see, I just took a screenshot of my VM. I do have Caddy, I have Metasploitable 2, and I also have Windows 10, which I use throughout my time here at Purdue. So I am actually going to start up my VM and show you guys how I access Windows on my Mac using VirtualBox. So I'll go ahead and click that and just hit start. It should be loading up. Another thing that I noticed is that the VirtualBox is a bit slower. I don't know if that's just my Mac or if anybody else experienced that, but it is a little slower to load and log in. But eventually, it will get there. This just loads up. And it's like a typical Windows login screen. I'll put in my password. Again, I apologize. It's a bit slow. Yeah, so it looks like that. I'll try to make the screen bigger. Yeah. And there you have it. So I will go in here from the start menu. I have like a typical start menu for Windows. I can access the internet using Microsoft Edge over here. And as you can see, it's slow. And every time I run this, my computer gets really hot. So I'm like, I don't know. I feel like one day it's going to just explode or something, because I don't know why it always gets so hot. But yeah, this is the internet, and I can browse. I can do a lot of things that I would normally do on a Windows computer. So to conclude, do I like Mac? Yes, I do, because it makes my life easier to organize. But for education purposes, I would have gone with a Windows, because it's just easier to get through a lot of my labs that way. And that is all I have.
All right. Thanks, Coco. I'm taking over from Audrey. She had a class to get to.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks. That was interesting. I know that a lot of the times when I'm doing tutorials, coding tutorials, they use a Mac. And I'm like, why? You're the opposite.
Yeah.
All right. Mauricio, are you ready?
Yeah.
All right. Take it away.
Okay. Okay. Can you guys see my screen?
Yep.
Okay, perfect. For my masterclass, I'm doing it on reverse engineering or software reverse engineering. I have a bit of imposter syndrome doing this class because, as my disclaimer says, I have actually mastered nothing. But I really wanted to challenge myself with this and kind of get out of my comfort zone and see, like, hey, you know, what can I really accomplish? You know, can I really learn something that, you know, I may find really useful, you know, later on or just in my career, you know, kind of going forward. But really where my level is probably right around here. I really got my butt kicked, researching this but I did, you know, manage to learn a lot, and I'm hoping to kind of convey some of the things I learned to you guys. So what we have today is kind of what, you know, what is it? And I think I actually deleted one of my slides, but we'll keep on. At its base level, it's understanding the functionality and capabilities of a piece of a program or a bit of code. And that's a really kind of simplified way to put it, but it's just one of those things that, like, at the base level, that's really all you want to know is, you know, kind of how this thing works. Some of the key points that we're going to be going on are malware reverse engineering typically follows malware triaging. You don't necessarily jump into malware reverse engineering right away. You kind of want to get some initial information up front, and then you want to conduct it in a controlled environment. You know, you can use just a regular VM if you need to. It's kind of what I have running, but if you kind of set up something like a sandbox, it's kind of like when hackers use Kali. Your reverse engineering in a sandbox just gives you a lot more tools already in place that you don't necessarily have to install or just set up. It's just kind of there for you, and you know, it just makes things a lot easier for you as, you know, a malware analyst or a reverse engineer. One of the big things that you really are hoping to accomplish is kind of create IOCs for a particular exploit or a malware program. You really want to just kind of help either your local defenders that are kind of combating this or the cybersecurity environment as a whole. And just kind of, you know, maybe kind of influence the authors of that malware to kind of rethink, you know, what they're doing or kind of come up with something new. And then that's kind of one of the biggest things for us as defenders. There's not a whole lot of ways that we can kind of target malware authors, but exploiting their tools is kind of the big thing that we can do. One of the biggest reasons why this is so costly for malware authors is it's something called the pyramid of pain. If you kind of go into DoD security, you're going to get talked to about this a lot. So if you expose like hash values or something like that, malware authors can very easily change those IP addresses, you know, especially with things like, you know, cloud instances and different things like that. You can set up, you know, little droplets in or, you know, AWS instances and just kind of roll through different IPs, domain names. Again, you can kind of change network and host artifacts. They're a little bit more annoying. Maybe you have a C2 server that everything kind of talks back to. And then you have the tools. So this is what you spend a lot of time kind of, you know, you spend dev cycles on this. You know, you have to test this. You have to run it against different environments. You know, you have cycles of programming and, you know, troubleshooting and different things like that. So if you expose these tools, you create this kind of huge gap where malware analysts and authors have to kind of come back to the bench and, you know, spend more and more cycles on it to try and evade the defenses that, you know, you've exposed. And this really helps with identifying the TTPs. So if certain malware authors go and, you know, leverage a specific DLL or, you know, a protocol like SMB, and you kind of expose those in the ways that you, you know, reverse engineer how their tool works. And if those tools kind of are fluctuated together with other tools that they've used, you just end up really kind of forcing them to change the way that they behave. And that takes time. In cybersecurity, there are very few legal ways that you can impose cost. You know, the NSA has attackers, the military has attackers, but in the civilian world, there isn't really a whole lot besides just, you know, reverse engineering their tools or putting their IPs or hashes or artifacts out there so that the community as a whole can kind of expose those a little bit more. Whoa. Some of the useful prerequisites that I really wish I would have kind of delved a little bit more into before I started hitting on this topic were more programming experience. I have some Python, but C, C++, and Golang would have really helped a little bit more. Assembly. A lot of the things that you kind of run into when you're doing reverse malware engineering is that this, you don't have access to the source code, so it gets compiled and you have to run it through a disassembler. And that disassembler outputs it in assembly. And so I literally had to start, you know, line by line, Googling every single thing. And so having some more fidelity on, you know, assembly and, you know, what it was and, you know, just being more kind of knowledgeable on it would really help that. Understanding assembly concepts. Assembly isn't like a one-stop shop. There are different assembly architectures, you know, for, you know, Intel or M1 or different areas. API understanding, a lot of malware starts leveraging APIs, so it might not necessarily be in the source code, but once it starts running, you know, it'll kind of query an API and have that get something for it. And it could be, you know, just a method to defeat debugging or understand if it's in a virtual environment. And so definitely more understanding on how those works and how those can kind of be leveraged is going to be big. Macro understanding, kind of following the same as API understanding. And then the CPU architecture, that'll kind of go back and help you with, you know, when you're looking at the assembly, what are the different codes that those CPUs kind of use? Setting the scene. This is really, you want to have the right environment before you begin the analysis, because you are kind of detonating this on your system. So make sure that you have, you know, a sandbox. There's some of the industry standard sandboxes and, or, you know, at the very least a virtual machine. You definitely don't want to start deploying this on your domain unless you have, you know, a specific machine that you have a honeypot on or something like that that sits outside. But, you know, even that comes with its cons. The initial phases are going to be some of the biggest things that kind of help you later on in your kind of malware analysis. This triage, it just kind of gives you starting points so that when you get into the assembly, you kind of know a little bit of more of what you're getting into. In many cases, you get this by, you know, some of the tools that are already running in your sandbox. Strings is really helpful. You can see on that top dynamic. This program cannot be run in DOS mode. That lets you know that you have an executable, and then further down in that program, you can actually see that it is leveraging the kernel 32 DLL, the MSSVCT.DLL, and then some of the processes that it's going to go after. And I'm sorry if I'm talking a little bit quickly, but I'm trying to get through on time. Tools of the trade. This is going to be one of the biggest things that I kind of I was just unaware of. But some of the biggest disassemblers that the community uses are IDA Pro. This is a paid for product. So there is IDA Free, but this is one of the biggest tools that when you see kind of reverse malware engineering videos or different things like that, a lot of the top pros are using IDA Pro or Ghidra. Now, Ghidra is actually an NSA developed tool that has now become open source. This is something that has a big community, and it is getting more and more advanced every day. Debuggers are very big because it allows you to step through the code without running it all at once. So you can kind of figure out, okay, if it makes a network connection and it goes out to this, you can, you know, see, you know, what the domain it tried to get to, or if it kind of fails at a certain port, like why did it fail, instead of having to go back and try and redo the whole thing. Hex editors and monitors for different things. The data that you're going to get is going to need to be manipulated in some way. And so whether you have process monitors or auto runs in place, there is going to be something that you need to have so that you can churn that malware in something that would be effective for your local defenders. Some of the add-ons that you that like HydroPro or like some of the sandboxes will come with are Burp Suite. Yara is a big for signatures. And then Zeek is kind of a network monitor that is really, really big. And it is also open source too. But if you do have, you know, CoreLite, you could leverage that. There are a ton more tools. I could spend just hours on all the tools and, you know, different things that you can kind of use, but those are some of the biggest ones that we have. This is essentially what you end up looking at. Malware authors will develop something in source code. It then goes through a compiler, gets transferred to the machine in binary. They can't get away from this. This is the machine readable language, so they have to be able to talk to the machine. So this is what you kind of leverage as an analyst, is getting this in a decompiler. It'll decompile the binaries and kind of put it out into assembly. And so that's what you have on the right to read in a lot of cases. So if you're not familiar with assembly, it becomes really just trying to go through those different binaries or DLLs or executables and step through it if you're not familiar with that. So I would really highly recommend, you know, if you want to jump into this, getting more familiar with assembly. There are different paths that you can kind of pick. Static malware analysis is a little bit less complex. Dynamic malware analysis is really where you get into the meat of things. The static malware analysis, a lot of you have probably at least done the basics of it. You look at the binary without executing it. Its efficiency is largely based on automations. And these can be something like, you know, virus total automations or Yara rules that you leverage against this environment. It does not find artifacts that are created as a result of executing. So if your binary executes and it, you know, does a DNS request to, you know, whatever domain and it waits for something and it never gets that inside of a sandbox or inside of a virtual machine, it just won't go to the next task and you're kind of stuck. But the biggest pro to this is it's a little safer. You know, you're not actually running the malware. You're just kind of seeing, you know, what is inside of it that you can see during, you know, using different automations or different things like that. Dynamic malware analysis. This is the sexy, in my opinion. The analysis of the malware as it runs. So you're actually detonating this malware, allowing it to run as it's intended, and then kind of verifying, you know, what you can, you know, what information you can glean from it. This can also be used in tandem with static malware analysis. A lot of times you may start with that and then kind of move on to dynamic and then verify what you find, because sometimes in static malware analysis, you can actually generate false positives. So it does come with the risk of infecting your environment, though, if you haven't properly set it up. Static analysis can be very effective against malware that's been previously identified. A lot of people that, you know, just run something in VirusTotal, that is in essence a form of static analysis because you are looking for their signature. But you know, this is kind of low level stuff. If something that, I did say sexy. Yeah. Thank you, George. But this is something that you're going to be able to do quick turnarounds on something like this. If you're a malware engineer, you get different rules and different things like that, but you can review, you know, different portable executables. You can see if the malware is packed. You can try to break obfuscation using some of those tools like SSDeep. One of the things that I really found interesting about something like that, because I didn't realize that some tools that did this, SSDeep actually chunks the files into different sections and then hashes those different sections. So and then checks those against a library. You do have to pay for it, but it does have that opportunity. So just because somebody salts something or just because somebody alters that, you still may be able to get some signatures from, you know, different types of tools like that. This is kind of something that I already talked about, so I'm going to just keep going for the sake of time. Dynamic analysis, this is essentially what it looks like, and this is kind of what I got my butt kicked in. But on the left there, you have kind of an itemized, you know, how the code runs and how it's written. You kind of start seeing how it kind of jumps back and forth based on different obfuscation techniques. However, on the right, this is a little bit cleaner for something that if you're not all the way used to this, this actually kind of breaks the different functions apart in what they call specifically. So it gives you kind of a graphical overview of how the malware runs. dynamic analysis is going to be hard because the enemy gets a vote. So if you start running this thing and they have any checks, so if it does, you know, a DNS check against its C2 server and it notices that it's not necessarily, maybe if you're doing this as a profession and that has a, you know, a base64 encoded cookie that was for a particular customer and you are not that customer based on, you know, a public IP domain space, they don't necessarily have to do anything for you. So creating a copy is really big for some of this more upscale or APT style malware, because a lot of these things end up having either self-destruct sequences or they just won't run anymore as soon as it doesn't get the first parameter that it's kind of requiring. So you really want to create a copy so you can either try it again, or, you know, if it does have something that self-destructs, you don't want to keep asking for a file because it may not be there anymore. Dynamic analysis is big when you leverage it with other tools. So when you're looking for specific artifacts, like I said, if it runs a DNS query or something like that, you can use Archimede or Zeek. Find that, query that across your network, and see if there are any other machines that have queried that same domain or, you know, are going to those same C2 servers, and then use a tool like Volatility to scrape the memory off of those endpoints so that you can get whatever the artifacts that are living in memory that may go away if the machine gets turned off or would never kind of arise in your sandbox since it, you know, it never goes past a certain point. Sorry, I feel like I talked really fast there, but I was trying to kind of gauge for time. These are some of the references that I've used. So, you know, I can either put these on the CyberWiki or, you know, just kind of post the presentation and then some more training. I kind of want to ask you, Angela, I had a little bit more of a practical piece, but I know I'm over time.
Oh, it doesn't matter. I mean, we got you. if you want to continue, that's fine.
Okay. Let me see if I can get my VM up. Okay. Can you guys see that?
Yes, we can.
Awesome. Okay, so for the sake of time, I'm going to go ahead and kind of figure out. Somebody has let me know that they have found some malicious piece of software or program, and they've kind of given that over to me. So one of the things that you can kind of run inside of your virtual machine that has some of these tools already loaded is you can kind of see what that file is. So just running the file command, it may not say it's an executable, but there you can kind of see that it is an ELF file, which is a Linux-based executable, what the bit sequence is, and then the actual Intel. Then that will help you with the architecture. So when you run it into something like a disassembler, you already kind of know that you should have this parameters already set. So this is that NSA tool I was talking about. It's something that has a lot of videos and a big open source community on, so it's kind of the one that I prefer. But the installation guide I actually have in the references, so if you guys are wanting to see a little bit more about that, you can just kind of check that out. But we're just going to take this, run the file, and it'll already kind of sort that out for you. It'll kind of detect, you know, what it is, you know, what the language that's going to be using, and just kind of set that up for you. It'll give you a little bit of kind of a summary of what it thinks it is. You can kind of use this for, you know, troubleshooting or validating, you know, maybe some static analysis that you did, and kind of know what you're getting into. Hopefully this loads. It crashed last time. Awesome. So it'll do some initial analysis for you as soon as it opens the file. I don't necessarily have enough time, but if you just want to run the defaults, that's normally pretty good for what you're going to be, you know, especially if you're first starting out. And this is essentially what it ends up looking like. So when you're viewing your DLL or your ELF or, you know, whatever the binary that you have, you can kind of go over here and figure out, you know, what this thing does. I normally like going into functions to see, you know, what this thing actually is going to be doing. And then I normally end up going to, if I find this, like the main portion of what that file is. It'll give you some of the variables that it runs. And in this case, we ran strings against it previously. And this is what we ended up seeing. So this is what I ended up searching for to get to this point is give me code to run. This is actually part of a CTF that I have in the references. So if you kind of want to get more of the walkthrough, you can go there. What I like about it is if you kind of highlight something, it'll put you where that disassembler or where that code kind of comes out on. And then you can, you know, from there pivot to where you might find something more valuable for your analysis. In this case, we're going to go to execute because I want to know where the file is executing something. And in this case, you have the call, and these are registers, values for the architecture of the CPU. And these are kind of where this is kind of where I got my butt kicked. But for the sake of kind of continuing on, you take those. You take those registers and you put them into a kind of a Python file or something that I had kind of already created, and you run that against the Pico CTF, and this is actually like the Carnegie Mellon CTF, and you can see that it'll actually give you the program as it runs on like their C2 server essentially. This is actually as far as I was able to get, so I'm sorry, I wanted to kind of give you more about this, but initially these register values were what that CPU architecture likes to deploy and kind of give you where they where the malware kind of is putting its parameters. I'm not explaining that really well, but essentially you end up Let's see if I can get to actually where. I put that. So these essentially are different register values that I was able to find in Ghedrum. I can't really explain in this short of time how you end up going about carving all these out. And I didn't end up doing it all successfully. I was only able to get to the prompt for the C2 server, but not necessarily through to the flag. But this is kind of how you step through this environment, or you know, whatever program that you want to do. You can do it on, you know, ELF files. You can do it on DLLs. You can actually run this through Microsoft files and just kind of make sure what they're doing is what it says it's doing, and kind of validate them in that way. And that's probably all I have. I'm sorry. That was less exciting than I wanted it to be.
Oh, it was pretty exciting. That was very interesting. Thank you. I like to see it, you know, on screen rather than just text. I'm a hands-on person. So thanks for that. Does anybody have any questions for any of our presenters tonight? No? All right. In that case, I'd just like to thank all of our presenters for tonight, Sean, Marcus, Coco, and Mauricio. Thank you guys for your awesome presentations. We learned a lot, as usual. And thank you for those who attended. And there was a lot of interactions that was nice to see. Next week, we do have a masterclass, and we have Jane, Tiawan, George, and Frederick. So be sure to join if you can. And I just want to say thanks again, and you all have a good night.